Self-Help SatNav is brought to you by Open Forwards. Get the latest insights into stress, anxiety, depression, relationships, work, time out, and getting stuff done by swooping over to www.openforwards.com. So today I'm going to be talking to Joe Oliver, who is author of Activate Your Life, along with a couple of other gentlemen, John Hill and Eric Morris, who unfortunately aren't joining us today. But nonetheless, we have Joe with us. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Jim. Hi. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It's nice to talk to you again. The last time I saw you was up in Birmingham and you were doing some training up here.
That's right, yes. We were doing a introductory workshop to ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy training. So, yeah, introducing the ideas to some CBT therapists and folk up there. It was
excellent.
Good workshop.
And we managed to fortunately get in our customary meat feast.
Yes.
In the evening, didn't we?
We did. Yes, the classic Birmingham meat feast. Something of a tradition now. Every time I head to Birmingham, I start to salivate.
Well, I'm glad it's become a tradition. It's much welcomed. And so why are we here tonight? Well, we're going to talk a bit about your book, aren't we?
Yes.
And Activate Your Life, full title, Using Acceptance and Mindfulness to Build a Life That is Rich, Fulfilling and Fun. And this kind of fits in with the theme of the show, really, which is about finding self-help that is of use and that has some kind of credible evidence base as well. And knowing about acceptance and commitment therapy myself, I'm pretty comfortable that we're in good territory here. Joe, to begin with, can you tell us a bit about yourself, kind of who you are, what you do, where you are?
Sure. So I'm a clinical psychologist based down in London. I work in a variety of different places. I work in the NHS, so I have firm roots with the National Health Service. I do a bit of training, training up non-psychologists in psychological interventions, and I have a specialist interest area working with young folk and their families who are coming out of the other side, recovering from episodes of psychosis. So that's my key part of my NHS work. I'm also a director for Contextual Consulting, which is a consulting firm down in London here. We do lots of training and clinics that are purely focused on offering and training up people in ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, or mindfulness interventions. So we do a wide range of different things there for practitioners, clinicians, coaches, psychologists, that kind of thing.
Fab. Okay. And so before we get a bit into the book and acceptance and commitment therapy, can you say a bit about when you first got into it and why?
Yeah, good question. So it was a few years ago now that I very first came across it. It was a good friend of mine, Eric, who we wrote the book with, Eric Morris, and he is really interested in this, and he's got his finger on the pulse, it would be fair to say, in a lot of the new advances. He's an early adopter in some respects with technology and these kind of things. So he really had his finger on the pulse with ACT. And he just slowly introduced me to it. And it's a fascinating model, I think. There's a lot of good science behind it, as you were talking about before, a lot of good evidence, which is really appealing. And there was just something about it that just personally resonated with me. And I don't know, I'm not sure if that's always necessary, but part of it for me is when I come across a model or it's just something when it clicks with me, I find it appealing. And, you know, the thing that stood out to me is it was in the word acceptance, which is a really unusual word. It's catchy, it's provocative, And it's hard to grapple with. But the thing as it unfolded for me was this piece. It was kind of like, I don't know, offering this suggestion that maybe the struggle wasn't always necessary. And that was just a revolutionary idea for me personally. And perhaps noticing the times in my life where I'd struggled with stuff or was fighting against things. Just a suggestion, maybe there's another way to approach this stuff. It was really fascinating. So started from there, and gradually got more and more involved. And there's a real ACT community out there internationally of like-minded folk. And so it was really, really nice to participate in this community, become a part of. And that was another thing that really drew me in as well.
Yes, yes. So I guess you're talking about the Association of Contextual Behavioural Science, the ACBS community, which equally I found welcoming and hospitable and, thoroughly enjoyed being a part of. It's so you're talking about being introduced to it there by Eric, who I know is an active tweeter.
Yes.
Pointing us in the direction of relevant science and research.
So, yes.
Thanks, Eric, if you're listening. And so let's kind of look at the book. Well, actually, let's talk about John first. Let's not leave John out.
Sure.
As he's also co-author. Can you say a bit about John?
So John Hill, he's a corporate, an executive coach, corporate trainer. He does a lot of well-being, health, resilience training for big companies. So part of large rollouts of training there. Working also with leaders, corporate leaders, and thinking about really strengthening people's resilience and using and incorporating mindfulness and ACT within the training that he's doing. So it's really fascinating talking to him from the angle that he comes at. So as you can imagine, on the spectrum of people we talk with ACT about, so when I'm meeting, say, a young person who's going through their very first episode of psychosis, and he's working with some leadership exec team, curiously, the same exact same processes apply. This is the strange thing. But as you can imagine, there's a different language to talk between those kind of groups of people, sort of a different language and a lingo and a way to convey these ideas. So him and I and Eric, between us, we have a lot of fun sort of figuring this out and thinking about language and different ways to convey all these kind of ideas. So it's a really, really interesting process. But sometimes it sort of feels like absolutely speaking a different language at times.
Well, that kind of seems to seamlessly link into my first question for you, or my second question for you, Joe, which is about who the book is for. Because if you're working with that group over there that you just described, and John's working with this other group over there, then it seems like has the potential to be for quite a few different people.
Yes, exactly. You can see the cunning marketing strategy right there. That's what we're aiming for. No, we were thinking about making it broadly applicable, so at the same time really accessible as well. So in language that is with the technical jargon is dialed down. So really working hard to try and come across with terms and ideas and concepts and metaphors that would relate to people across the board. The book is structured in a way we have different kind of module parts for different skills. But we also try and cut across in terms of some of the main areas that people struggle with, the key parts where people kind of get locked in a little bit tight, as it were, when there's not much room to move. So those areas are related to depression and low mood, related to anxiety, related to like problematic anger, and anger really gets in the way. And also this other kind of broad concept about self-esteem or self-identity. So, I guess if you think about it, it would be pretty hard to find anyone on the planet who hadn't at some point in their lives struggled a little bit with at least one of those issues. So we would hope then that the concepts and the skills that we talk about, have a wide degree of applicability.
Yeah, fairly ubiquitous kind of experiences or struggles, it sounds like you're describing there, but something about when people really get stuck, which is what you go on to talk about kind of right at the start of the book, isn't it? About this idea of getting stuck or getting unstuck. Can you say something about that sort of premise and a bit about what you're trying to achieve in the book there?
Yeah, for sure. So we kind of, our angle in there was that being stuck is a normal part of life, and there's nothing strange about it. There's nothing unusual. There's a lot of good opportunities that come from being stuck. And, you know, not wanting to come across like a motivational speaker where everything is fantastic and shiny, but we really do truly believe that. There's some interesting things that happen within that time of being stuck in life. And at the same time, that we angled it a bit like to think about, well, how to maximize those times and move through them in a skillful and effective way so that stuck becomes kind of useful. Can be not like entrenched, not like unnecessarily spinning of wheels. So thinking about some broad set of skills that can be applied for those points. We also took the angle, which was to suggest that 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 stuck doesn't mean broken. Stuck just simply means stuck. And how to move through that and flourish from those points, and you know, having lives that rich, fulfilling, and fun, as we put it. We think that's really important. Also kind of drawing on the fact that, as good evidence suggests, that for most people, most of the time, there's at least some point in their lives where they have actually applied the skills that we're talking about, these skills of open, aware, and active. So in some respects, what we're suggesting is how to draw on the strengths and abilities that already lie, and maybe, you know, in a way that wouldn't necessarily be so intuitive to apply, but thinking about using those skills in areas that haven't been so well rehearsed or used before. The kind of like the basic angle that we took with the book.
Okay. So could you give an example of somebody or something that brings in these three ideas of open, aware, and active?
Okay, let me use a personal example that for myself, then, that maybe kind of brings us alive a little bit. Personally for me, just given my history and what I've kind of learned and the experiences I've had, there's times for sure for myself when I notice myself getting a little stuck, or as you could say, a little narrow, as it were. So a recent example of this is when I had to stand up in front of a bunch of people and give a fairly unprepared presentation. And I remember walking into the room kind of thinking it was going to be a group of, say, 10 people, and it turned out to be like 200-300 people. And if I'm honest, I noticed my heart rate start to pound a little bit. I noticed my mind start to go and get a little judgmental and evaluative. And then when the first speaker stood up, who was like a national expert in the area that I was talking in, my mind went a little faster, heart pounded a little harder. And it was absolutely an opportunity for me to get really stuck, and by stuck I mean kind of like just falling a little bit back into myself. So within that space then was there was an opportunity for me to bring in the skills that we've been writing about. So the first was open. So that meant really me genuinely noticing the struggle and the invitation there to really get caught up with the thoughts and feelings and want to get rid of them and try and talk myself out of them or not feel certain things. So bringing a sense of openness to that, allowing those feelings to be there, noticing my mind at work, thanking it for doing its fantastic job of trying to keep me safe. The second skill was being aware, so bringing a sense of mindful awareness to these processes, but also like a little bit like spotlighting outwards. So where my mind really wanted me to get caught up with it, just gently, compassionately pushing my attention back outwards, back out to the task at hand, to the things that are around me, noticing anxiety as it ebbed and flowed, my mind going, noticing that. And then very lastly, really engaging with the active piece, which is kind of like, why was this important? And, you know, as it happened, I was there speaking to a bunch of really keen and interested psychologists and therapists about ACT and the application of ACT for folk with psychosis, something I'm really passionate about, and I think there's something really important in that. So keeping that in mind was that I was there to do a job, and it was an important one, something really mattered to me. So for that instant, I was allowed myself to be willing to experience this anxiety, take this risk, step out of my comfort zone, and, you know, notice the possibility that all could go terribly, horribly wrong, and just be mindfully aware of that process and take the step out to do something important and active. So, yeah, I guess you could say, wrapping that up, a good example where I could have got stuck, I could have, like, you know, really got pulled into it, and just bringing slowly those three skills, open, aware, and active, just allowed me to participate and do something that was really meaningful for me.
Okay, yeah. So I'm getting a sense with your example there, Joe, of how that getting stuck can happen. And I think of getting stuck in your own head and being really inwardly focused on those thoughts and worries that were showing up. And almost like that, then you're really exaggerating your anxiety and it becoming worse as you possibly get preoccupied with that. Mm-hmm. And so you're giving a road out of that, it sounds like, in your description, which is to try to take a step back, try to notice that, try not to... You said something about thanking your mind there, which seems along the lines of not seeing your mind as your enemy, which is something that's talked about, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that feels sometimes a little provocative too, to say, because minds say some pretty scary things at times, but this is a really new way to build a different relationship with our minds. And it's about whatever it takes to be able to do that. So not a relationship that's based on, I always have to listen to my mind. My mind is always right. It always tells the truth. It always deserves to be listened to. But this kind of stance that's like, yeah, okay, thank you. We appreciate that. You know, I've got some other things to focus on and, you know, I appreciate the chatter, but I'm going to refocus outwards. I'm going to hold what you say kind of lightly and not do things that are going to enhance or exaggerate, as you're saying, that struggle or that experience.
And that tone that I hear in your voice there about the way you say, it's kind of, you don't sound like you're struggling with your mind too much when it's kind of, when you respond to it like that.
Yeah, you can get that, right? Like even just the sort of tone that comes from it is that sort of lightness to it, which, you know, there's some practice in that sometimes minds can be really heavy or scary. And doing things just to build in, to step out of that automatic pilot way of responding and always zooming into our minds. But yeah, doing things that help to hold it a little lightly is really important. A really nice skill to have in the psychological toolkit, as it were.
I guess there is something to say about kind of the trickiness of this as well. You said it takes practice, and that we're talking about this rather briefly and rather quickly here, and the framework that you've presented can sound simple, but I guess in reality it's something different.
Sure. So I would say this is the kind of angle we took in the book, is that absolutely these are though just like skills that anyone can learn, and we really firmly believe that. And so like any skill, right, it takes kind of wrapping your head around it a little bit. It takes like a good supportive environment to be able to practice this, and environments that are safe, that give you lots of positive feedback, usually help, where there's lots of opportunity to make some mistakes and screw it up, because that'll happen, and then come back and keep practicing. One of the metaphors I really like, as a good friend of mine told me, was that it's like folding your arms. And I don't know, Jim, if you're like most people, you probably fold your arms like in one particular way every time without just thinking about it. Automatic pilot, bang, your arms go. And usually if you're right-handed, your left hand ducks down, or whichever way. And when you do it the other way, it feels weird, it feels clunky, it's just like really awkward. And nonetheless, though, this is the skill that we're building in to step out of automatic pilot, to become aware, pause, make some room and space for the clunkiness, and really focus on why it's important. And, you know, maybe kind of folding your arms the other way, I don't know, I can't see the immediate benefit, maybe there's some there, But you know, what if it was like about something really meaningful, like, I don't know, opening up to someone really close to you, or taking a step out and doing something really purposeful at work, or some big bold move in life? Then perhaps folding your arms, you could see you might want to practice a little more and move through that clunkiness and come out the other side, so that it's a skill that's available, that's easily you can pull out of your toolkit when you need it at those points.
So I guess don't be put off then by things feeling strange just because they're different, because they're new.
Yes, exactly that. That's such a good point. I think so many times that we are put off just at that very first starting point, right? We start to do it and just it feels weird. It's out of our comfort zone. It just feels unnatural, and we kind of, you know, freak out a little. And our minds go, ah, that's terrible. That's never going to work. That feels strange. And it's just at that point, with that little bit of extra persistence, encouragement and support to move through that period. And then suddenly, what do you know? You've got something like really cool that's available to you to be able to use.
And my experience of the book is that you're trying to take quite a helpful, practical approach. It kind of reminds me of some of those other books that I've read before in the Overcoming series that focus more on traditional CBT methods. Mm-hmm. Was that one of the aims, if you like, to sort of really make it kind of practical in a way that people are familiar with?
For sure. Yeah, definitely. And that Overcoming series, I absolutely love. And, you know, I grew up as a baby psychologist reading those things and frantically kind of flicking through, learning all these new approaches. And I think that is brilliant. I think self-help books that are written from a good evidence base, but that are written in a clear, non-jargony, not necessarily scientific language, is so important. So coming from experts who know what they're talking about, but make a real effort to translate topics and ideas in a way that people can pick them up and run with them easily. Super important. I think it's a really necessary and vital part of the profession for us to be doing this translational work.
Yeah, and you're helping people to implement within this book as well, and I think that's a really important content aspect of self-help books, materials, because that's what we all struggle with, isn't it? You know, we can digest information, we can get excited about ideas, but the implementation is often where we all fall down.
Definitely, right? So it's that piece at the end of, you know, getting the new ideas, getting the toolkit, and taking it out and actually using it. And I think it's just about, like, you know, a sense of shame sometimes. You know, you get these really cool, kind of nice looking, sexy, shiny tools, and they're great. And then it's like a couple of months later, it's like, oh gosh, I'm in this stuck situation here. What do I do? And I forget about the cool tool and the toolkit. And you know, it sounds a little dull, but that I think is the really important part of any change, is just simply going, hey, I remember, that's right, there's another way to do this. And the kind of, I guess, the dull bit is just how to remind ourselves that this is available. It's like, hey, there's a new trick here. I don't have to fold my arms always this way. I can do it this other way. That is also available.
And I guess there was some persistence required in the writing of the book, Joe. Whether you'd done that on your own or doing it as a three, that I guess as you kind of worked your way through that, that felt a bit clunky at times. And you know, I guess I'm asking, what was the experience of writing as a trio?
Yeah, so it was honestly fun. It really was. It wasn't all fun, and I admit right at the end there, as that deadline was looming, there was some kind of parts where we're thinking to ourselves, why are we doing this? But for a good chunk of it, it was lots of fun. And the three of us, we come from different approaches and different backgrounds, so we have different ideas that we spend a lot of time. There's a long lead-in we spent, probably a good kind of, I don't know, 6 or 12 months of just getting together, thinking, writing, occasional beer, and maybe a chicken wing got thrown in there as well. We might have done a bit of that, but all to kind of like just sort of get the ideas sort of flowing around, and of course, getting our kind of writing style together as well. So it's not only important to have the right ideas, but have a way that's consistently tells these ideas and is a consistent voice. So, you know, that's important to kind of get across as well. So, for example, Eric and myself, I guess we come from a kind of an academic background and, you know, writing academic papers, and which can come across as a little dry and dusty. And where, for example, John is he's done tons of writing. He is definitely a wordsmith. He's, I think, the world's, as far as I know, only video game poet, which maybe gives you any indication of his writing abilities. So you bring all that together, like these different styles, and yeah, getting a consistent voice was important.
Yeah, it's a good measure of a book, isn't it? Where you can't tell the writers apart through the chapters.
Yes.
Because the writing style is so similar.
Hopefully we've achieved that a little bit.
Okay, great. Well, it's lovely to talk to you, Joe, about the book. And I have read it and I use it in my work with my clients, and I've got some good feedback as well. And I see you've got some good 5-star reviews on Amazon. Yeah. And so I'd encourage people, if they're looking into for something along these lines, that this is definitely one to pick up. Got any other books on the horizon, Joe?
Yes, we're in the process of working to a deadline right at the moment. It's with some other colleagues, myself and Eric, and Emma O'Donoghue and Louise Johns. The four of us are writing a book on ACT for psychosis. So we're pulling together some of our experiences of running groups. We've done lots of group interventions over the years. So this is a manual for practitioners. So putting together these ideas and experiences and helping people to set up and run their own groups based on our manual. So it's really exciting. It's a really fun, practical book. Not at all academic. So making it as user-friendly, a user-friendly manual, as it were. Very excited about it.
Great, great. And when do you hope that to come out?
That early next year, all okay. Going well. Yes, yeah. Our publishers are breathing down our necks, so that will happen.
And you were talking about the event in Birmingham that you did at the beginning, and so you've done London, you've done Birmingham. Are you doing any more of these events?
Yes, I'm doing. So next on the grand tour is up to Manchester, and then up to Glasgow after that, and then back down to London again. So it's the full tour. It's the tour bus. It's the t-shirts. It's the whole thing.
Oh, okay. I'll keep an eye out for your bus then.
Indeed.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Joe, and I'll talk to you again soon. Thanks for coming on.
Great. Thanks for having me, Jim. Talk soon.
Bye.